Pittsburgh hockey.
Yeah.
I'd like to send a...
Hazel Marlinwood. I'm speaking on behalf of the Peterborough chapter of Hopes International to tell you that you're listening to Trent Radio 92.7 FM. Quality programming for the Peterborough community. Oh, turn that music down, please. Turn that music down, please. It's hurting my ears. Turn that music down. Excuse me, I said that was hurting my ears. For the love of God, turn that down! Turn that down! It's hurting my ears! Excuse me, will you please turn that down? I said turn that down! Turn it down! Turn that down!
All right, welcome to another Art Space Noise Space.
We've been making a lot of noise lately.
We have.
What's the deal with that?
I don't know. It seems like people are ready for the booty these days. Well, maybe.
Yeah.
Yes, no, to catch you all up, Full Metal Booty played Osea at the end of last month.
It was Monday.
That was Monday. I know. It was last month, though.
Okay. True. It was pretty surreal. Mm-hmm. Whenever there was sort of a lull in the jam, people sort of clapped.
Yep.
But they looked around nervously, is like, are we supposed to clap?
Yeah.
Or what?
It's true. It's true. Well, and I mean, this is one of those weird things with what we do with the booty, is that it doesn't have defined songs, so people aren't quite sure if they're supposed to clap or not.
Don't know when a song is over, or
because it's not quite as obvious. Although at one point we got a really, it sort of like it trickled, and then it kind of swelled into a big one. So,
but the whole thing was over in 45 minutes.
Yeah. Which, you know, some people have a hard time with excessive noise such as that.
But it wasn't excessive. I thought it was a pretty mellow jam.
I know. But that just goes to show that we're sort of indoctrinated, right? And later this month, we are going to be doing, coming up on the 9th, we're going to be at Trent Stock. which actually looks like it's coming together to be a pretty trippy event.
I saw a partial list of some of the guys playing.
Mm-hmm. I saw a poster from a distance for it. I just saw that it had Trent Stock at the top, but I was in a rush, so I didn't get a chance to stop and look at it. But it was in very psychedelic colors.
Yeah.
And then on the 22nd of April, we're going to be at The Spill. There's going to be a long lineup of drone bands from various countries in Europe. And we're going to close off that evening with some great booty. Mm. Which, as I was talking with Dave Toby last night, and he was saying that, and I was, you know, sort of saying that it might actually be a really good lineup for us in particular, because people are going to be then a little bit more ready for what we do. as opposed to one of the very first gigs I ever played with Full Metal Booty at the Trash, where we ended an evening of hardcore punk and we cleared the room.
That was fun.
Yeah. And that was kind of my introduction to booty, because I think I'd only come out to like maybe two jams before that. And
and we blew away the punks.
We blew away the punks. Yep. That's got to say something. I just wanted to mention that before the station ID, I was playing something called Pornophonique, a band on Jamendo, doing some epic 8-bit, which we were discussing has quite an interesting sense of humor to it.
I'll explain 8-bit.
Well, 8-bit goes back to the old computer music. And many of your early video games, particularly Nintendo, that's one of the things that most people, when they hear that music, think of the classic Nintendo. Personally, I think of the VIC 20, but that's...
Yeah, our Commodore 64 had quite a good sound chip.
Yeah. But the 8-bit is actually the lower end, because it's got that very distinctive, chirpy kind of...
Right.
And of course, the 8-bit comes from the fact that it's 8-bit sound. Most things now are either
16 at least.
At 16 at least, usually 32 point float.
Well, CDs are still 16-bit.
Yeah.
DVD, I don't know if that's any higher, but Blu-ray definitely is.
Yeah. Now, inside of that, there's different ways of encoding as well, different ways of compressing the music and stuff.
Yeah.
But certainly the 8-bit, you doesn't matter what you do to it, it still has that distinctive chirpy crackle around the edges.
Yeah. Well, if you record a voice in 8-bit, it sounds like it's coming over the phone or something.
Yeah. No, exactly. Yeah.
You lose all the higher frequencies.
Yeah. And the low end. It's just that, very small bandwidth. And because of the stair-stepping, you get that around the edges. This band, Pornophonique, they are from Germany. Or I would say, combine this like crazy acoustic folky kind of sound with this 8-bit. And if you listen to the lyrics, they're actually sort of take the video game universe as the starting point and then do these kind of...
Right. What was that track called? Something about...
That one in particular was...
Send me to the bonus screen? Take me to the bonus level.
Because I need an extra life. later I should play Lemmings in Love, which actually has a female vocalist. There's a whole duet thing going on there.
Cool. See, I brought something that I want to play as well. I saw this at the dollar store, and surprisingly, I've gotten some really good albums there.
Right.
Like from Jewish folk music to African reggae, Scandinavian folk music,
right.
Birds of prey, bird calls.
Wow. Screechy.
And this one. I saw the name and I recognized it, Lord Running Clam.
Okay.
At first I thought it was from a Vonnegut novel. It sounds like
it does, yeah.
But it's actually from Philip K. Dick, Clans of the Alfane Moon.
Oh, really? I love that book.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's the one where all the mental patients are sent to live on this planet of their own, and they organize their society according to their pathology.
Yeah.
The paranoids live in Adolfville. The manics live in Da Vinci Heights. The obsessive compulsives live in Hamlet.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that there's, I guess, certain properties of the moon that actually amplifies.
Right.
So it sort of turns their mental proclivity into a superpower almost.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for that to happen to me.
Yeah. Anyway. Now, is there an actual film version of that novel? I've heard rumors, but...
Not yet, but there's... No. I think there's like 3 Philip K. Dick novels in production right now.
Right. Yeah, no, I mean, he's always been the source material for so much.
Right.
But I have to say that Clans of Alfane Moon, in terms of doability, you could probably do it on a very low budget because it's not spectacular sci-fi. It's much more the human kind of interaction.
Sure, it's not a big budget special effects kind of movie.
But it's like got some very...
Hollywood gets hold of one of his stories, they can turn it into that.
Well, that's the
like
other
they did
side.
With Total Recall.
Right. Oh, man. Yeah, yeah.
It's really funny that David Cronenberg heard that these producers were planning on making Total Recall.
Oh, yeah.
And he called them up and said, I want to be involved. And
right.
Kept harassing them, writing treatments and started working on the screenplay and just wanted to, they said, okay, listen, all right. We are making this movie.
Right.
We're casting Schwarzenegger in the lead, and Cronenberg never called
Got
him back again.
Not surprising. Yeah.
Anyway, the one thing that convinced me to buy this was, well, for a dollar.
Yeah.
How can you go wrong?
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can, but not,
not that much.
It has a track called Flibberty Jib, which is the name of a Ken Nordine track.
Okay.
And when I brought this home and listened to it, it actually features Ken Nordine.
Wow.
And this album is about 10 years old, so Ken Nordine was about 80 when he hooked up with this techno guy.
Wow. Now, is it in the machine right now?
It is.
Okay.
Deck 2.
Deck 2.
Track 4.
Okay. It's right now sort of spinning through stuff, so I'll just put it at 4 and give it a pause. All right. So I guess we'll just play that one then and come back after.
All right.
I can turn that down now. CD2. All right.
There was this stranger who came into our town, who was tall and dark and had eyes that could look right down into the bottom of you. One evening that was different from any other. He got us all together in the big auditorium. There he stood on the huge stage. The only light was on him. We were in the dark. Then, out of his tallness, came the chanting. First as a whisper, we could hardly hear. Understand. It trapped us without our knowing it. Possibly it was his manner. Up there the way he was, chanting on the high stage. We came alive to him as he slowly moved us with his chants into insistent, savage, throbbing crescendos of ecstasy. To remember.
Well, wasn't that a treat? That was Ken Nordin.
And Lord Running Clam.
Lord Running Clam. That was pretty trippy. And we're looking right now at Ken Nordin's website, which is wordjazz.com. And there's lots of things on there, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Lots of audio to check out. Now, do you want to give a little bit of a background on
Ken Nordin? Yeah. Mm. People our age and older will totally recognize his voice.
I do.
But not know where
exactly
where we know it from.
Mm-hmm.
Well, hundreds of advertisements, voiceovers,
right.
Narrated documentaries.
Mm-hmm.
A great voice. But starting in the late 50s,
mm-hmm.
he started reading his weird poems and stories with a jazz band.
Cool.
And I was thinking that this is actually before Kerouac did that.
Mm.
But it was on the same label.
Right.
Dot Records.
Right. Well, I think, again, like, movements come, like, they kind of bubble up. And, you know, we, in retrospect, kind of pin certain people as the kind of highlights. But if you look in the context, you see that there's whatever they were doing was going on around them. It wasn't
right.
Like they didn't exist in a vacuum.
Well, an early beat reading became legendary for its psychedelic light show.
Right.
In 1960 or something.
Mm-hmm.
No one else had been doing that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But Ken Nordin did, let's see, what Word Jazz was the first one.
Mm-hmm.
He did a few records on that label.
Mm-hmm. There's the discography
there's
there.
There's about 20 albums there.
Yeah. But yeah, the earliest one there is 1955, although it looks like it was re-released in 63, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, no, the Word Jazz was the second one. The first one was Passions in the Desert. Passion in the Desert. So, and that was a different label, FM.
Yeah, I've never heard of that album before.
Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, the starting in 57, that's when Dot starts creeping in.
Mm-hmm. In 66, Colors.
Mm-hmm.
That's it's a cool album.
Mm-hmm.
That's he tells the story of all of the colors, 24 different colors,
uh-huh.
in short poems. They're about a minute long.
Cool.
And it's also the record album is a game. So in the back cover, you've got squares all the way along the edge,
mm-hmm.
and supposedly it came with 24 tubes of paint and surreal instructions that. We had to roll dice and paint on the walls. And
wow.
He wrote a book called Crumple,
uh-huh.
which is a bunch of individual pages,
uh-huh.
which are crumpled up and put in a box.
Okay.
And you reach in at random, smooth one out, read it, crumple it back up, put it back in the box.
Wow. Wow. Well, I mean, that's along the lines of the cut-up and those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, as we've talked about before, has its roots probably before that, but the Dada movement had, you know, Tristan Tzar was the first one to write out the instructions on how to construct a poem, which was kind of the first...
Cutting up the words and...
Yeah, putting
them
in
out of a hat.
Bag or hat, yeah, and, you know, and, but of course that, you know, evolved over time and is most well-known with Burroughs, of course.
Right.
Which...
this is mm-hmm. a good one. Devout Catalyst is an album mm-hmm. he made with Jerry Garcia and Tom Waits.
Wow.
And Tom Waits is a great fan,
mm-hmm.
so it must have been a blast for him to record with Ken Nordin.
Yeah, yeah. No, and I can totally tell, like, when Tom Waits gets into that kind of storyteller mode, he gets that sort of voice.
Yeah.
Actually, a little while ago, I saw on YouTube a clip from Fernwood Tonight.
I saw that. The piano has been drinking.
Oh, my God. That was so hilarious. and, of course, I mean, that old Fernwood Tonight, Mary Hartman stuff was just so bizarre. And Tom Waits just fit right in. I think one of the first... exposures that I knew that I had of Tom Waits when I actually knew who I was watching was there's a concert movie, and I know that the one thing that struck me was he did this whole song and it was kind of a close-up of his face, and at the end of it the camera kind of zooms out and he's holding an umbrella that's on fire.
I haven't seen that.
Is it
taken on stage?
Yes. Yeah, it's
Big Time?
Maybe that's it. That could be it.
I remember the live album from that.
Okay.
But I haven't seen the film.
Right. It was my friend Robin Kelsey. We used to hang out at his house. It was funny. In Bancroft, he ran a cafe for a while, and then the landlord sold the property. So he ended up moving the cafe to his house. So he used to hang out there and play music and watch vids and play lots of Scrabble. Scrabble and chess. But anyway, it's a complete aside.
Well, let's see. That's an incomplete discography.
Yeah, I love the way that it's got... It's kind of like it's written as a complete, but then in brackets is the N and the in to make it in an incomplete.
He also did a syndicated radio show for years.
Uh-huh.
And on his own label, he's got over 300 cassettes.
Wow. That's crazy. Well, I mean, there was a... Especially in the 80s, there was a huge cassette, underground cassette movement.
Right.
I know that Soviet France was one of those bands that they came to my attention as doing crazy kind of cassette art, where they would do these like bizarre packaging.
Right. They also released albums in screen printed burlap sleeves,
mm-hmm.
stuff like that.
Yeah, no, crazy, crazy stuff. Really sort of developed in parallel and in combination with the mail art kind of movement.
It's I miss that, you know. I
picked up on it years later when I lived at Dragonfly,
right,
because there was a bunch of the stuff from that was there. That was where, you know, I first stumbled onto Huckam Bay, temporary autonomous zones and
that
stuff
makes
like
sense.
That and they also had at Dragonfly, I found a whole bunch of zines from the Moorish Orthodox Church and things of that nature.
Right.
You know, just radical stuff.
I used to have a whole pile of weird homemade cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
People had written the stickers themselves and they distributed them, you know, 20 of them,
yeah,
45 of them or whatever.
Yeah. Well, and that's what I was going to say, that there was like these strange cassettes that had like just way too much folded up and stuffed inside.
Right.
Independently produced vinyl, all that kind of stuff.
There was one called Black Humor, known for their creepy packaging.
Right.
They had one that was melted together, so you'd have to saw the thing open to get the cassette out.
Well, I guess that's kind of like the equivalent of the theater of cruelty in a way.
Somewhat, yeah.
Try to be kind of antagonistic with your audience.
Mm-hmm.
Now, as a side note, our sort of modern equivalent, this is the other thing, is that I see all of that stuff as leading up to the internet or the World Wide Web.
Right.
You know, in that in the late 80s, there was a movie, Pump Up the Volume, with Christian Slater, cheesy movie. But it was he was doing an underground radio show out of his basement. It was very cool because it really identified this, you know, desperation for some sort of voice. Because of course he captured the imagination of all the high school students in the area, and the movie ends with him being arrested, but then you hear the voiceover of all these people starting their own. And so this was the idea of like, just go out and do it. But of course that was before we could all go out and make our own website and have our own MySpace page and whatnot. You know, I think that it's very much that we are living in the age of communication, and that at the underpinning to all of this digital technology is actually communication.
Well, one of the great things about cassette culture was the cassette four track.
Oh, yeah.
Because then you could record two tracks.
Yep.
Send it to some guy in Belgium or Japan.
Yep.
Who'd fill it up, the other two tracks, mix it down.
Yep.
To two tracks again, and then send it off to somebody else.
Yep.
Or people could make albums, whole albums, without ever meeting.
Mm-hmm. No, it's, yeah. And again, you know, like, it's the early formation. Like, we were, you know, obviously there's a drive that we have to want to do this stuff, to put ourselves out there. Mm-hmm.
Well, and also to participate in the making of our own culture.
That's right.
Rather than just...
consuming.
Right.
Yeah.
Turning on the TV.
Yeah. Yeah. Doing the zone out thing. And yeah, that's where, you know, like earlier in the show, I was playing a tune from Jamendo, which of course is one of my favorite sites these days. There's just everything you could possibly imagine, and mm-hmm. it doesn't have all the nastiness of MySpace. I find MySpace really annoying, because every page the sound starts right away, and everyone loads their page up with all kinds of flashing colors, and
right, and the sound starts right away, which yeah. makes it difficult to queue stuff up.
Yes, yeah. And have been a longtime Firefox user, so I tend to use tabs a lot. And
right.
You can't do that on MySpace.
Really?
No, because you open another tab, it starts music. So it's just like, yeah, no. Whereas I find that when I'm surfing around on Jamendo, you know, I open a whole series of tabs, and it's cool because the music player is integrated when it has a little pop-up. And if you push play on any of the pages, it comes up through the pop-up. So you always have one stream of music and you have full control over it. So it's a nice system.
Right.
But again, it's this whole drive to empower the individual and individuals out there to develop culture, their own culture. Other than this kind of crazier stuff, I've also been listening to a lot of trip-hop on Jamendo, which I've been finding that trip-hop seems to be a genre that has a lot of politic going on, which I like. It's probably not exclusive to that, of course, but mm-hmm. I'm finding that consistently when I'm listening to trip-hop, I'm finding like a lot of political stuff, like the one band Black Era, also on Jamendo. The first album I listened to had two different pieces that had Chomsky mm-hmm. Pieces embedded in it. And they actually tuned me in. I don't know the name off the top of my head, but there's a couple of Italian anarchists on the new EP they have. And I went searching, of course. And the mm-hmm. one, very interesting, his take on the Situationist uprising was that he actually was on, this is crazy, on the side of the cops, because he's seen the police as being the working class. And the, you know, the kind of, the intellectual revolution as being these, you know, kind of spoiled rich kids.
I can see that.
I know. It's just like, and again, I love this kind of like, okay, like it challenges, you know, there's no black and whites, there's no clear answers. And it's like, yeah, I can sort of see, especially if you were in the front lines of that kind of revolution, you would mm-hmm. probably be able to see things in a different perspective or have kind of a unique take. Because I do know that's one of the critiques of the Situationist uprising, was that it wasn't very practical,
to say the least,
and it was because it didn't come from the bottom up,
right.
as opposed to some of the stuff that happened in Spain, which was more from the peasants,
right.
And so they had a much more kind of immediate grasp of what needed to be done day to day in order to survive.
Yeah, right. They didn't have theories, and they didn't need them.
No,
they needed action.
They needed action.
And yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Situationism is throbbing with theory and meta theory and meta theory and
Which, I mean, this is the thing, is that we do need context, and that's what we've just been talking about in terms of, that's what culture is. It's mm-hmm. context, you know, is right. A way of kind of making sense of what's going on around you.
One thing that's a mystery to me is that mm. no one has admitted to where the money came from to publish the Situationist journals.
Oh, yeah.
And they were printed on fine quality paper
mm-hmm.
with gold edging.
It's true.
Like expensive books.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they were distributed cheap or free.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Where did all that money come from?
That's a good question. Do you know?
I know a whole bunch was stolen from the student council of some university.
Well, that's what I was just going to say.
They blew the entire year's budget on publishing and distributing the poverty of student life.
Right.
One of the major essays of that era.
Right, right.
And then they all got arrested.
Right. Yeah, well, because that's what I was going to say, is that I know that the nature of being in a university, you do have access to various equipment, publishing equipment, et cetera, that, you know,
right.
probably contributed to. And then it makes sense that they invaded the coffers of the, you know,
the oppressive
funds.
State or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. But again, yeah, it's one of those situations where it's not exactly practical. But I do see what people are reaching for. It's
right.
I've also been reading Escape from the 19th Century by Peter Lamborn Wilson, where he sort of is talking about basically looking at the writings of Nietzsche, Marx, Proudhon, and Fourier. And seeing how what they were talking about back then is still unresolved. You know, so we're
right,
still...
So we're still escaping from the 19th century.
Exactly. We're still in the same loop, right? It's just we've gone through this big arc and sort of back to some of the same things. Now, of course, we now have... There's certain mechanisms that we have access to, like we were just talking about communication, tools of communication. And I think that's what's changing things. Mm-hmm. Just like the Gutenberg galaxy had its profound impact way back when and precipitated all
right.
of this cultural change, I think that the mass communication devices are now, you know, changing us yet again. How that's going to turn out, it's anybody's guess, but...
Well, I've already noticed, long ago, noticed the declining attention spans.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's kind of insulting to watch a documentary on quantum physics and string theory.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is cut together like a rock video.
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, that's that's the hip new thing, baby. and it is... Now, it's a push-pull, because on one hand... Yes, it's a short extension span, but at the same time, how many hours can you sit in one spot without moving, staring at a screen? Now, the things in that screen may be changing a lot,
mm-hmm.
but on another level, there's this hyper-focus. So it's this kind of like, they're kind of paralleling each other, right?
Right.
Where it's like, yeah, you need this constant like brain stimulation changing all the time. But at the same time, being able to be completely absorbed, unmoving, for hours at a time.
Mm-hmm.
I just know this as a kid, when, of course, I was a TV head. I grew up being sat in front of the big glass babysitter.
Mm-hmm.
But there was hippie kids around who had no access to television, right? And then mm-hmm. they would get it. When they would come and visit me or, you know, be at these sort of things. And it was interesting. I found it interesting observing how they absorbed the television in that they were not able to sit still. After a certain period of time, they would get fidgety. They'd still be interested, but they would be fidgety and need to move around and stuff.
That's odd.
Whereas the kind of like the TV addicted kids could just sit there vegging for hours. So it's a weird kind of thing, eh? Like, now the other thing is that the development of the ability to multitask.
Right.
So I guess what I'm saying is that I have a dialectic brain. So whenever I see a negative, I always sort of look for the positive. And whenever I'm presented a positive, I look for the negative and sort of...
That's a good way to go.
Yeah. It's in some ways comes from, you know, my own predisposition, but then, you know, in recent years of reading things such as Robert Anton Wilson with the idea of maybe logic and of course, I mean, Marx himself, the material dialectic, how's this? Materialist dialectic? How do you say that? Anyway.
Dialectical materialism.
That's it. I knew it was one of those. But of course, he was drawing on the idea of the thesis, antithesis, and synthesis, right? The dialectic. And I think that it's something that I mean, it goes back to, you know, the three pillars of Zen, and, you know, which is absolute faith, absolute doubt, and the pillar of wisdom that rises from having a foot on both.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay, that makes sense now.
Yeah, and that goes way back. And that when you look at the yin-yang, right, the Tao is actually three. You're seeing the yin and the yang, and then the Tao is the whole thing, right?
Right.
So, I mean, this kind of this, that, and the other thing, I think is kind of embedded. But again, I think that we're in a time when that those sorts of things we're kind of, it's alternating constantly, right? So
right.
We're flipping back and forth, and that comes around to that multitasking idea of being able to sort of hold multiple kind of viewpoints all at the same time and sort of see overall patterns and those sorts of things. It comes from lifetime of being marketed to as well.
That's a bit of a creepy thought.
Yeah, well, again, you know, like it's a weird sort of thing because I've been going back to Tim Berners-Lee, who first published the HTTP, which gave birth to the World Wide Web,
right,
in the late 80s. And he was talking about the three stages, as he saw it, where, first of all, trying to develop a universally or as universally accessible as possible communication system. And then from that, being able to sort of externalize the human consciousness into something that's, you know, kind of that we can look at.
Yeah.
And then from there, kind of figuring out what it is that we're here to do, you know, like that the age old question, you know, like now that we can actually look, can we come to some conclusions or at least get some sort of idea of what direction might be good? And strangely enough, I do see that the data mining of Google and Facebook and the like actually facilitate that, even though their mandate is to do it for marketing.
Right.
The underlying sort of like patterns and stuff that they're finding could actually be very useful in understanding what the heck we are. Rather than just using it as a tool to tweak us and sell us stuff, it could actually be utilized to figure out.
Okay. What I'm worried about, though, is how we're analyzed.
Well, yeah.
Every time you you visit a site, that site is visiting you. And
it's true.
There have been controversies about selling people's information.
Yeah.
And I kind of find it shocking sometimes that Big Brother doesn't have to watch so much because people are voluntarily giving away all kinds of information.
Right. Well, and that is the sort of thing where it's like there's so much information that they almost need to go to the meta level.
Yeah.
Because getting specific is just, you know.
But I've seen some consumer surveys that were just, I mean, people somehow feel that you have an obligation to
fill
it in. In order to serve you better, we need the following information.
Right.
And there's the one that came with the Dremel tool actually was insane.
Mm-hmm.
There's stuff on there that you're not legally bound to tell your therapist or a cop, you know, people are writing them in. Well, you know, got to fill in all the answers.
Right. Someone gave me a form to fill out. I must fill in the blanks. Yes. No, and that's what I was, you know, sort of what I'm sort of looking at is that, it's a weird thing because the intention of the people that are collecting, compiling, and utilizing the information right now is dubious at best, right? It's like when I'm watching television and I'm watching commercials, I see how there's, you know, every single sound, color, shape, word, you know, is marketed to death. So that these commercials, the way they're written, they're actually written around things that have shown to connect with people or tweak people.
And get their attention in some way.
In some way, yeah. And there's no real analysis of what those things mean or you know, any of that sort of stuff. It's just, okay, this kind of bell makes people pay attention, so we're going to put that bell in, right? Not analyzing, well, what is it about that bell sound? What is it that, you know, like they don't go any deeper than.
It's functional.
It's just functional from their kind of perspective. But like I say, I do see that that information in the long run might actually offer us some very interesting insights into human nature.
Yeah. Well, eventually, if the guys collecting it actually let people use the information.
Yes. Well, and I think that's a part of...
They sell it, so...
They do sell it. And this is one of the things that I'm seeing is that over time, I do think there's going to be more and more demand for that type of information by more and more people.
It'd be nice if a sociology department would get its hands on it.
And that's exactly...
Rather than just another marketer and advertiser.
No, exactly. And I think that that's the sort of thing that we might actually start seeing is that the sociology departments and those types of things are going to start saying, hey, this is information that we should look at. And, I mean, it's not contrary to what the marketers are doing. So they might not be too resistant to having that sort of analysis done.
Well, because they could benefit from it too.
Exactly, yeah.
From having somebody with a different perspective look at it and find things that they wouldn't necessarily see.
Yeah.
A similar thing happens, I think, with autopsies and all the statistics collected, mostly for insurance purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's intruded onto people's lives and their deaths.
Right.
They're for the benefit of profit-making corporations.
Right.
Now, once that information is collected, a medical analysis could turn out trends that wouldn't have been seen otherwise.
That's right. And then that, of course, could help strengthen the services and the systems that are in place that are actually there to help people.
If it gets used that way.
Yeah, well, exactly. And I mean, I think that that's the reason that I'm bringing this stuff up is to sort of like, because I know I'm not the only one thinking these thoughts and, I don't live in a vacuum, but is to get people to sort of think in those sorts of lines of, because I think that some people, sort of get to the point of like, data mining and marketing is scary and sort of stop there, right? Just to try and like, okay, wait a minute, okay, let's look past this. And yes, some of the things that are being done are kind of nefarious. But the other side of that is like, okay, how can we pull something from this, I mean, the internet itself was a military thing in the first place.
Right. and then industrial after that?
Academic.
Academic before industrial?
Yeah.
Ah, right, okay.
Yeah. Because the industrial didn't quite know what to do with it at first.
Uh-huh. okay, but the academics were first big users of email, is that right?
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. I think I was mentioning to you before the grandmother or grandfather of all demos, where Doug Engelbert, demonstrated in 1967 or 68, a system of, hyperlinks, virtual presence, co-document authoring over distance.
Right.
And all that kind of stuff. It was crazy. And it was mainly university-based, all that stuff. Of course, he was at the demo. It's on YouTube, so if you go search for Doug Engelbert.
I will.
It's, in some ways boring as snot because it goes on for a long time, but it's fascinating that he's doing this stuff. And I read some other, sort of commentary, and people at the time thought he was crazy. And that,
yeah, no doubt.
We're just like, what's he doing? Because, he had the mouse, and they had, what do they call it? The bug.
What's the bug?
The bug was the pointer on the screen, because it was just this little, dot.
Right.
Scurrying around on the screen. But, yeah, and it was like a multi-button mouse that he had. And this other kind of buttony thing.
Right. He had a stenographer's keypad, or
it looked like that. Yeah, it had four or five.
It's a one-handed.
Yeah,
yeah, and you've got like five keys or six or whatever.
Yeah,
but by combining two or three keys at a time, you get all of, you get the whole alphabet, the punctuation, the numbers, everything you need.
Yeah, because he also had a QWERTY keyboard in the center.
Right.
But he was actually mainly using this mouse and
well, yeah, if this mini keyboard thing had caught on, like he'd be using that with one hand and the mouse with the other. You could just fly.
Yeah.
So why didn't it catch on?
Just, why didn't Beta? it's all about the, you know, who, what company markets it and how it flies from there. But, it was very interesting because, like at one point they had, it was video, right? So the screen was actually a picture of him, but then laid over top of it was the actual text of the information he was working with. And he was showing basically hypertext and multi-tagging systems.
Yep. I think that's Parker.
Parker coming in. And then at a certain point, he then connects with this guy that's in an office at this other university. And so it goes split screen so that you can see both of them on the screen plus the document they're working on together.
Nice.
Yeah. I was like, wow, that's so cool.
Just noticing, we've got about 9 minutes left.
Yep.
And we probably should say something about Art Space.
The 50-50. That's right. Which is the this year's annual 50-50 is coming up on April 18th. And the theme this year is April in Paris.
That's only 2 weeks away.
It is. It is. It's coming up fast. Now, it's this same as last year, where it's with a $100 ticket that puts you in a draw so that you get your choice of the art that is on display. And again, it's 50-50, so 50% of the proceeds go to the artist and 50% go to ArtSpace. Now, the exhibition of all the works will be displayed starting on Wednesday, April 15th. And it will continue through to Saturday, April 18th, which, of course, will be the actual draw.
Starting at, let's see, the doors open at 7?
Right. 1900 hours.
And 8 o'clock, the draw.
Right.
And then silent auction.
Mm-hmm.
And why a silent auction, I wonder? Because the last couple of years, there's been a live auctioneer.
Yeah,
and it's
sure.
gotten quite lively.
I know. I'm not sure. But yes, I'm not sure why the silent auction this time around. I know we're doing the balloons again, which is always a good crowd rouser.
Yeah, well, I put a prize in one balloon,
yep.
and nobody took it.
Oh.
Which is kind of too bad because it was to invite somebody to be on the show on a Saturday to come and jam with Mandlisher.
Right. Well, I put in a couple tarot readings, which I did last year as well.
Yeah.
Yep. Which is cool, because people have been using their free tarot readings.
Good.
Now, it doesn't actually say when artists are able to submit work on the website, and I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm assuming that before the 15th, when
that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think. Probably we have an email.
It's true. I don't have my email on me. I suppose I could log into my Gmail, but I'd never go that route. I check my Gmail with my Thunderbird.
Right.
Because I hate the Gmail interface. It tries to assume too much about what I want to do.
Okay.
Whereas, yeah, I find that with the Thunderbird, I can set it the way I want it to be. Parker's coming in. Now, there was a... Was there something else that you wanted to play? I seem to remember...
Not offhand. There is another Ken Nordine, the first track.
Okay. Well, let's cue that up, and we can...
do our paperwork.
Do our paperwork and sign off our show. Yes, I guess we will be back next week. The end of the season is not until the 24th. So
that means there are two more Saturdays.
Two more to go.
And then Trent Radio will be off the air for a week and a half or two weeks for tuning up the computer system.
Right.
And getting ready for the summer season, which is a lot more wide open.
Right.
In the past two summers, I've done 5-hour marathon.
Right.
Last year, you had your show from 4 till 5.
Right.
So, and then after that, we would go and jam some more.
Yeah.
5 hours is too much to be on the air.
Yeah.
But I did write that article for the Trout Rodeo.
Right.
And people are invited to come and jam.
Mm-hmm.
I've said this, I don't know how many times, and how many people have actually shown up.
The odd person that you actually know and talk to in person.
Most of them are quite odd.
Yeah.
And John, formerly of Full Metal Booty, used to come and jam.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, maybe we'll get some more stuff churning out this summer.
Well, I think we can meet a bunch of people at this gig,
yes.
At the Spill.
Yep. Yes, and the Trendstock.
And Trendstock.
Trendstock.
We should bring Trout Rodeos with us.
That's right. And the Trendstock is coming up on the 9th. So it'll actually be before the next show, right?
The 9th of this month?
Yeah.
Oh, man.
No,
I thought it was the 9th of next month.
No, it's coming up
man.
Fast. Oh, yeah. Nope. It's that's another thing to keep an eye out for, folks, is the Trendstock. Sounds very interesting. Lots of stuff. It sounds like a day-long extravaganza of craziness and weirdness and all that fun stuff.
I can hardly wait.
Mm-hmm. So, in the meantime, let's go over to some Ken Nordine and...
Lord Running Clam.
Lord Running Clam. And we'll see you all next week.
What do they mean? The faces in the night. Looking into the antique mirror. Are we this face? By what insistent instinct do we crowd the smoking dark and watch with our seashell ears the pounding truth break against the huge inchoate spirit of all we are? Are we this face? And why do the stars of this spirit's music shine with such intensity upon the double zero of our blinking eyes? Are we this face? The questions multiply the mystery. Whatever it is, that delightful I don't know what next.
Yeah.
Tired of playing run, sheepy run, and follow the leader. The game we're looking for is looking for us. And it's called 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, green light. Great, big, huge, unbelievably infinite dose eyes.